Good afternoon, and welcome to the Virginia Festival of the Book for Washington, entrepreneur, child of nature, and master planner. I'm thrilled to welcome everyone here on behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. I'm Sheila Blackford, and I'm going to be moderating our panel for today. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the City of Charlottesville for sponsoring the Virginia Festival of the Book and for providing this venue. This event is being recorded, and it's going to be broadcast on Charlottesville's own TV10, and it'll be available online at www.charlottesville.org/TV10. If you have any questions during the question and answer, we're going to start off. I'm going to have a few introductory remarks, and then my two panelists are going to talk. Then we're going to open it up for questions. Please wait to make sure you have the microphone before you ask a question so they can record it. Otherwise, the audience, the TV audience, cannot hear what you're saying. So just wait for the microphone before you ask the question. If you have a cell phone, please be sure to silence it. And if you're tweeting about this event, please use the hashtag VABook2016. Also, at the end of this session, the books we are discussing will be for sale. Please support our festival authors and our local booksellers by purchasing a book. The authors will be available for signing books after our discussion. Finally, the Virginia Festival of the Book is free of charge, but not free of cost. Please go online and give back or pick up a giving envelope from the information desk at the Omni and support your festival so that we may sustain it for years to come. As I mentioned, I'm Sheila Blackford. I'm the librarian at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. The Miller Center is a research institute that focuses on the presidency, politics, and history. I'm also managing editor of American President, which is a website on all 44 presidencies. Today's session is about George Washington, a man who really needs no introduction. As most of you know, Washington led the American troops in victory in the American Revolution and is known as the father of our nation. He almost single-handedly created the government for the newly formed United States, shaping its institutions, offices, and political practices. As the first president of the United States, Washington brought a restraint and dignity to the office that still dominates it even today. Except maybe for the primaries, right, that are going on right now. The books that we're talking about today bring fresh perspectives to our collective ideas about Washington. They reconsider Washington's legacy based on the latest research and examining new facets of his life to give us new ways to consider the father of our country. We were supposed to be discussing three books, but sadly, Tony Williams, the author of Washington and Hamilton, The Alliance That Forged America, is sick and couldn't be here with us today. Here with me today are Ed Lengel and Philip Levy. Ed Lengel is, who's at the far end, is the author of First Entrepreneur, How George Washington Built His and the Nation's Prosperity, which reexamines Washington's life using Washington's financial papers as the basis for its research. Ed is the director of the Papers of George Washington at the University of Virginia, the author of three books, including General George Washington, A Military Life, and Inventing George Washington, America's Founder in Myth and Memory. He is also a regular contributor to numerous history journals. And then Philip Levy is author of George Washington, Written Upon the Land. He is a professor of history at the University of South Florida and co-director of the George Washington Foundation team that discovered and excavated George Washington's boyhood home. He is the author of Where the Cherry Tree Grew, The Story of Ferry Farm, George Washington's Boyhood Home, and Fellow Travelers, Indians and Europeans Contesting the Early American Trail. We're going to begin this session with each of the authors talking about their books, and we're going to go in chronological order based on the period of Washington's life that they wrote about. So we're going to start with Philip, who wrote about Washington and his childhood home, a ferry farm, and then we'll move to Ed. After their initial presentation, we'll take your questions and get our conversation started. So, Philip, you want to start us off?
Thanks. Thanks for coming out. Everybody here okay? We're mic sensitive. So let me give you a little background on what this project is and sort of how I arrived at it, and maybe a bit about what I'm working on now and sort of get into some of the things that the book covers. I'm a landscape historian primarily and an historical archaeologist, and sort of found my way into Washington through that. Washington is a significant figure both as an historical figure, but also rather interestingly as a figure of memory, as a sort of a shadow, as I like to think of it. And I began the project, David Maraca, the director of archaeology at the George Washington Foundation, and I sort of started this project. He's the director there, and I have a faculty connection, so the two of us had been working together at Tidewater sites in Eastern Virginia. We sort of brought our little package over to Fredericksburg to begin work on the excavation there. And initially, I thought certainly that that was going to be an excavation about the 1740s, trying to understand the context of the 1740s and sort of make sense out of the world that Washington came from. And what started to happen was I got pulled more and more into the story of Washington himself and the impact of Washington on national narratives, on political narratives, and on the landscape. And the first book that I produced out of this was a book from 2013 called Where the Cherry Tree Grew that was a sort of a long-term landscape study. Obviously, the most famous story from Washington's childhood is the cherry tree story. That cherry tree story would have taken place at Ferry Farm. That would have been the landscape associated with it. And there's a long tradition of that story being told in the area and that story having an impact on that landscape. And that was sort of what I teased out. And when I was done with that book, it did a lot of what I wanted to do, which was sort of telling this long landscape story. What I wasn't able to do, though, in that one was really focus in on the childhood itself, on Washington's childhood. I talked about it in one chapter, but it was part of something much larger. And when I was done, I sort of felt there was a lot more to say. And that's an interesting problem because I get asked this a lot because a lot of this work focuses on the childhood years, on Washington's childhood years. And people want to know specific things about the childhood. There are a lot of sort of canonical questions that are longstanding, that have been part of our discussion. The question in some ways has been as much a part of the discussion for a couple hundred years as been the pursuit of the answer. So I wanted to say something about the childhood. And what I started to realize, kind of knew this as I was going in, but the book sort of played this out more fully, is that to ask questions of the childhood is really to open up more questions. The fundamental problem underlying all of this is that Washington was raised in a gentry family, wealthier than 90% of Virginians. So 9 out of 10 Virginians would gladly have traded places with him, at least financially. But they weren't at the absolute tip top. His father, Augustine, sort of in the lower end of the gentry, doing well, but not the most prominent. Living also on the Northern Neck, which is a little bit more of a marginal space, if you know sort of how the social function of Virginia worked. I'm playing some of that stuff out now, what I'm working on now. The Northern Neck is actually kind of an interesting hybrid. But it was an ordinary childhood for someone who there was no reason to assume there would be any important prominence emerging. From whom there wouldn't be any important prominence emerging. So as a consequence, he is no more documented than any other child growing up in the Northern Neck. A little bit here, a little bit there. No one anticipated that any of this would be needed. But something happened, obviously, in the trajectory of Washington's life, so that by the time of the American Revolution, really arguably by the time of the Seven Years' War, but certainly by the time of the American Revolution, he starts to become prominent, starts to become famous on the global stage. And something started happening that's sort of unusual that didn't happen to most people who lived there. And I think one of the first instances is a guy named Hazard, who's a bookseller who's in Fredericksburg about 1777. And in his notes, as he's talking about what he sees in town, that there's lumber stored because they're going to be building some ships on the Rappahannock. So he's sort of noting these things about Fredericksburg. And as a side, he points out, and across the way is the home where Washington grew up. Because he knows who Washington is at this point, and it's sort of a notable thing. Well, something very important is happening there. The association of a very famous name with a place is beginning to happen. And at that point on, from 1777 on, really, you start having people wanting to know a little bit more about that childhood. And as Washington's life moved on, we start to get biographers, the first being David Humphreys, a colleague of his, who actually started asking these questions. You start getting this sense that if there's this great man, well, what was the childhood like? So they start asking those questions when it's already too late to have any meaningful understanding from a documentary standpoint. Washington was notoriously reticent about this. He didn't really offer much. And anything that he might have written in his papers may well have been edited out in his process of sort of redacting and revising his own papers. So it's very hard for us to know what there might have been that he didn't want us to see. So not anything incriminating necessarily, but, you know, he's very, as Paul Longmore talks about in a wonderful book on Washington, still very, very powerful book, this sort of very strong need to self-fashion, to create himself, is a project, a lifelong project for Washington. So we get this interest in this childhood period without a lot to go on, not a lot of rich stuff to talk about. So as you know, I think you know the next piece of what happens. By the beginning of the 19th century, we start to have people filling in the gaps. The silence itself becomes something that must be filled. And the most famous of these silence fillers, as everyone knows, is Mason Locke Weems, famous Parson Weems, who by 1806, really completed by 1809, has written his sort of big compendious Washington biography that carries with it things like the cherry tree story and a whole bunch of other stories. The cabbage seed story, which is where I take the title of this book from, and the cover image, actually, which I can, it's not on the hardcover, fortunately, but there is from a 19th century drawing of the cabbage seed story, which was much better known when Americans were more agrarian people. It's sort of faded in memory. But the story there is that his father goes out, we'll tell it from the way the story's told. George goes out one morning and he sees his name growing in small seedlings in the ground. And he finds this miraculous, and he goes and confronts his father. He says, "You have to see this. You've never seen anything like this." Takes him out and looks at it, and they have a whole discussion in which Augustine says, the son sort of figures it out and says, "Wait a minute, is this a trick? Are you pulling a trick on me?" And Augustine says, "Well, is there anything that doesn't have an author? If this exists, there must be an author. And yes, I am the author of this. But who is the author of all of this?" And he points to the garden, and he talks about the verdant world of Ferry Farm and agriculture and the fish that jump out of the sea. Remember, this is the writing of Parson Weems. And he says that God is the author of all of this. So just as I am the author of this act, God is the author of all of this. And that story was very important in the 19th century. It's faded very much in our retelling. But all of these stories sort of fill this space, and we invent different things and have filled that space with a variety of inventions. So in trying to tease out, one act is to sort of say, well, here's what we know and here's what we don't know. And that's fine, and I do some of that. I certainly spent a lot of time going through biographies. I think I read about 150 Washington biographies. It's almost a random act. You just, you know, you did some of this too. It's, you know, well, here are the big ones, and there's a lot of writing that just fills the gaps in. But what I wanted to do was chart out elements of the childhood story to sort of see where they come from. Characters like the schoolmaster Hobie. Where do we get this guy from? There was a tenant of Augustine's. He seems to have been in Westmoreland County. But he becomes an invented character. All these people are invented. The relationship between Mary and George, his mother and the son, was a very important relationship, particularly in the second half of, or excuse me, after the 19th century, became of increasing importance. These things are created. There obviously was a relationship between these people, these historical people, but the weight of them, our understanding of them, is largely in the hands of the biographers, who are doing what they need to do in any given moment with these stories. And as Jared Sparks, who's one of Washington's early biographers, a very influential biographer, as he sort of says, and I can paraphrase it fairly closely, but the gist of it is that to say something bad about Washington is to say something bad about the nation. And true then as it is now, when we talk about Washington in some very profound way, we're talking about the nation. So however this stuff is weighted, whatever influence and emphasis we try to put on it, we are doing something bigger than Washington. And that's always sort of fascinating. There are very few figures for whom that much weight rests, on whom that much weight rests. So when going back to the childhood, We get to this issue of sort of, if he is going to be the father of the nation, then we cast ourselves as being the children of the father. Then you go to this place where you say, well, if we're the children of the father, then we would like to know what the father was like as a child. And so you get that pursuit. Now, I want to take another minute or two, and I want to tie up a theme that I talk about in the book. So what I do is go through a series of different visions of the childhood. There's an historical vision, there's a biographical vision. I spent a lot of time, understandably, on the archaeological vision. What is it that we see in that landscape? What does that text do for us? In many ways, the book springs from that question, because one of the things David Morocco, I mentioned before, is the director of archaeology at the George Washington Foundation. He used to say, I think I said it too, but I think it was more his quote than mine, when we had a lot of attention on this project in 2008, he said that we're going to offer a new text, we're going to expand, we're going to change those sections of the biography. And that's an interesting challenge, and I think it's correct, but it's not that we're going to use archaeology to answer questions that have long been outstanding, like where George was educated. How much French study did he have? Well not much. From Fort Necessity, not much. But, where do these things happen? Did he love his mother? Did his mother love him? These are not questions we're going to get insight on archaeologically, necessarily. But the archaeology produces a whole other text that gives us different insights into the functioning of space and social relations in the space in which that childhood is playing out. So there's an archaeological narrative. There's also sort of an historical memory narrative, which I play out a lot. How pieces of the landscape take on certain memory, how the effect of Parson Weems' ability to invent pieces of the landscape, invent stories for the landscape, how that property, in some respects, attaches to the landscape. And by the middle of the tour, or even before the middle, sort of the around the time of the Washington Bicentennial of 1932, the landscape itself is producing its own organic Washington stories that really are not connected to anything, even Weemsian, except the impulse to invent a story. So the landscape itself becomes productive of story. But one of the things I also chart out is a question of environmentalism. Because as I mentioned before, the cabbage seed story is an interesting thing. I'll sort of leave this as my sort of payoff. We forget what the cherry tree story actually meant. We get very focused on it as a tale of honesty. And we're focused on that because the 19th century taught us to see it that way. It took the story from a large body of storytelling, extracted it, and sort of said, right, the story is he tells the truth about cutting the tree, his father forgives him, and that's that. And most people who've read the story have only read that. The McGuffey readers, which began in the 1830s but carried on for much of the 19th century, Americans learned to read through the use of that story, but they read that story in isolation. The second part of the story, though, which most people don't follow, is this whole issue of the cabbage seeds. There's more that's going on, because what Augustine sees in the story is his son being disrespectful of nature, of treating nature poorly. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but cutting a fruit-bearing tree is a biblical sin. It's expressly forbidden in the Bible. And even though, I mean, it's more of a concern for Jews than it is for non-Jews, but nevertheless, Weems would have known this, right? He'd be aware of this. So there's an act in there that has some significance. Augustine then does the cherry tree, or after the cherry tree, the cabbage seeds and the sort of discussion of the land, taking George out into the land and saying, this is, God is the author of this, and there's a relationship there, and that you have a responsibility as the steward of the land to respect it properly. And he's basically doing what the last book of the Bible does, what Numbers does. The whole discussion in Numbers about taking care of the land is what Weems is doing. So in sort of extracting the cherry tree story and making it a story about honesty, we've lost a very important piece of that story that Weems wanted, which was that it's actually kind of an environmental parable. And in this era of the effects of climate change, we need to sort of think about how we operate and what our tools for operation are. And I got very interested in how stories like that fit into other possible means of storytelling to give a character like Washington, to give Washington's childhood story different kinds of resonances than we might otherwise have if we think of it exclusively through the lens of the cherry tree and truth and not truth. There's a lot more in there that we can tease out and ensure that we, moving into the future, will continue to see meaning in that childhood, to make new resonances from something that we've been making resonance from for a long time. So I'll stop there. And
that's great. Thank you so much. Sure. Ed, you want to take it from there?
All right. So as Phil indicates rightly, there is been a huge amount of work on Washington over the years. And when you try to identify, as people ask me, they probably ask you all the time, which book should I read? It's a puzzle, and people are always looking for the one volume, quick and dirty guide to George Washington. There's been so much, but it's ironic and fascinating that despite that, every time you look at him afresh and you look at him from a different perspective, you can realize that there's something new to learn about him, and to learn about him in the context of his times, to learn about the impact that he had on his times. And it certainly doesn't mean that he necessarily becomes greater or more remarkable. In some ways it does, but you can view him more and more as a human being and draw, I think, more connections with him the more you look at him. So I'm a military historian, by training. I also work on European history. I write about the First World War and a lot of other stuff like that. And my first book on Washington was A View of Him as a Soldier. I direct the what used to be the Papers of George Washington Project. We have changed our name, and I'll explain why in a moment. And I've been there for 20 years. I worked on his Revolutionary War papers initially and for many years and got to understand him as a soldier and what the military life meant to him. Well, last year we expanded, thanks to a grant from the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, and we are here at UVA, by the way, to incorporate the papers of Martha Washington and the Washington family. And we thought it seemed more appropriate at that point to rename ourselves the Washington Papers, lest there be any suggestion that Martha was an appendage or an auxiliary or somebody, oh, by the way, Martha was there too. That was one means of looking at Washington and the Washington family and Martha Washington afresh to begin to put all of them in context in their times. Another new perspective on Washington we began a few years ago was to begin work on his financial papers. We received a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, which is a granting arm of the National Archives, to assemble, edit, and publish all of his financial records, which have never been published before. They're extremely complex, they're voluminous, and they provide a new window on what was actually an extremely important part of his life. And so as I looked at this new content and this new material on Washington, I began to see, as have my colleagues, I have a couple of my colleagues here, that there's much more to Washington than simply general, planter, president. There's Washington in the context of his family. And I talk about partnerships and family partnerships in this book, First Entrepreneur. And there's a Washington for whom money was very important. And the first reaction when you look at that, you say, money was really important to Washington. You study his accounts from the very beginning, from his teenage years, all the way to the end. He was taking very, very careful records of his finances. The first reaction is, oh, he was really greedy. Money, filthy lucre. You know, he's only thinking about money. Actually, there's much more to it than that. So what I tried to do with First Entrepreneur was to take Washington from the family and through the childhood and to carry him through his early years in the French and Indian War and the growth, his marriage to Martha, the growth of the Mount Vernon estate, the Revolutionary War, the Confederation, and then his presidency to understand what role business, money, entrepreneurship played in all of those periods. So a few points, and I'll just quickly summarize that came out in the book. One of them, and I can start with family. As Phil rightly says, there are so many gaps, and it's so difficult to know for certain, simply from the documentary evidence, exactly what happened. But there's a good deal we can infer. First of all, if you look back at his family, and the first Washington, John Washington, came to North America in 1656. He was a merchant. He was an entrepreneur. He came to Virginia in order to load up his ship with tobacco and then sell it in Europe. Problem was, his ship sank. And we can thank that ship sinking for the whole future of the United States. So, like many Washingtons, he's very adaptable. His ship sinks. He decides he's going to stay in Virginia. He complains about it a lot, and that's another Washington characteristic. They're all complainers. They're big complainers. But he also comes to term with the facts as they are. He decides to stay in Virginia. He buys land. He makes a very good marriage. And here I'll pause for a moment to say, when we talk about the Washington marriages, all too often we've looked at it from the man's point of view, from the Mr. Washington's point of view, and says, yeah, he chose the right woman. I like to look at it from the other point of view and say that the woman chose, from her perspective, the right man in each case. you can infer a lot of why they might have chosen each other. And I think in each case, they see each other. If you look at George Washington's great-grandparents, grandparents' parents, they choose each other because they're partners. Because both husband and wife, in each case, are sober, diligent, determined people who are concerned with maintaining and developing their estates and to provide for their heirs effectively. You look at John Washington, you look at his son Lawrence Washington, and then you look at Augustine Washington. Augustine Washington, George Washington's father, was a very savvy businessman. He became involved in a lot of different business ventures, including ironworks. He went over to England, trade, land, etc., etc. There's no doubt that some of that attitude transferred itself to George. I also think his wife, Mary Ball Washington, really gets a bad rap, and somebody needs to write a good book, or at least a good extended article about her. We tend to look at things from the point of view of George later on, that he had a difficult relationship with his mother. We know that much, that especially as the years went on, they didn't talk to each other a whole lot, and I think it's safe to say they were alienated. And we assume that because George didn't get along with her, that she was bad. And or that she was, the stereotype comes down, that she was crabby, that she was stupid, that she was uneducated. She was a very tough woman. She was a woman who Augustine married in part because he saw in her somebody who is an excellent manager. And that's what she was, a very savvy, a very hard-headed manager. After Augustine died, when George was only 11 years old, George lost any opportunity he had to receive a standard education, a liberal arts education, and his mother insisted that he receive a much more practical education that's based on things like accounting and geometry and mathematics that are focused on how do you manage an estate well. And I think she taught him certain basic principles. Again, lots of this is inferral. From the sources, you can't find a letter from Mary in which she writes to George, here are all the things you have to know, but you can certainly see certain aspects in him from an early age, and one of them was an absolute horror of debt. He hated debt. Part of that was what he learned, a part of it was the experience, and I think if we look at George in the context of the Virginia gentry, rightly so, these were wealthy people, but they were also people who faced ruin on a day-to-day basis. George and his family were constantly seeing fellow planters, fellow gentrymen and families who were ruined primarily because of debt. And much of that debt came from their having to survive in the British colonial mercantilist system. And all of this runs as a thread through Washington's life, both in his personal affairs and in his public policy, was that debt is something to be avoided almost at all costs. So I follow through Washington's early years. A few things I would say. First of all, you have to see him as a combat veteran, which is what he was. As somebody who experienced war firsthand and all that means. He was somebody who is partly defined by his relationship and his marriage to Martha, who was herself also a very savvy woman, a very intelligent woman who was also an excellent manager. He was defined partly by his experience in the British colonial system. In the 1760s, Washington sees that this system, which depends on credit and selling tobacco through British merchants, results in debt. And he transforms his estate by moving over to wheat, from tobacco to wheat, so that he can become a merchant on his own account. Is an extremely important moment in his life, and it makes Mount Vernon into this self-sustaining enterprise. I say a lot about that. I move into Washington during the Revolutionary War, and I think as Commander-in-Chief during the Revolutionary War, there are also some new things that I learned. And very briefly, yes, he was an excellent manager of the Army. He understood administration very well. But I thought it was fascinating when I looked at Washington in the Revolutionary War again, even though I'd just written a book about it like 7 or 8 years ago, something I completely missed the first time is how he begins to use this phrase, communities of interest. He talks during the Revolutionary War about how interest is the governing principle of all mankind, and you ignore that at your peril. When I saw that the first time, I thought, this is just George Washington being cynical. He's in a bad mood. He's unhappy. He's saying, yeah, everybody's out for number one. What he's actually doing is taking a very realistic and hard-headed appraisal of why people do what they do. Why do they follow a cause? Why do they fight a war? Yes, it's for ideals, but ideals alone do not put bread on the table. Ultimately, people decide to fight based on, or to follow a cause based on, a daily calculation of, is there hope for me? Is there hope for my family? Does this give me a prospect of hope and a future prosperity? If you ignore that, then you don't really understand what you're fighting for. Washington believes, as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, and this continues through his presidency, that it's ultimately by trade, commerce, communications, and interactions that you convince people that they have a common and shared interest to follow a cause and ultimately to achieve victory. It's with careful calculation that every camp that he establishes as the commander of the army, he opens a market to trade with the population. It's not just talk to the governors or talk to the members of Congress. It's the army must be on a daily basis integrated with civil society. And this is conscious. Many Americans had believed at the beginning of the war that a standing army will become a power in of itself, and it will decide that its interests dictate seizing power and maintaining power. Washington says, no, we're showing that we share an interest, we share a community with the people. And he talks about that's how you bind the nation together. Now, I continue beyond the Revolutionary War, and a couple of points that I'll mention before I finish. During the Confederation period, Washington becomes a great advocate of experimentation, innovation, the development of manufacturing technology, and of farming in America. And it was very interesting to me that Washington appears in the Confederation period as an early advocate of the internet, what we would think of as the internet. In that, he says that information and the acquisition of information and knowledge, the classification of information and knowledge, and the dissemination of information and knowledge is ultimately the key to growth and prosperity. And he develops partnerships with some of the leading figures in the British agricultural and industrial revolutions that are going on to acquire that knowledge globally, and to, through publications, through agricultural societies, through other organizations, to share that with the American people. He's also an advocate of industrial espionage, by the way. And the British passed these laws that say you can't share, you know, you can't get information on technology from us or import skilled workers. Washington multiple times tries to circumvent that until I think Jefferson tells him, Mr. President, this could be a felony. He does say a felony, and Washington says, well, maybe I'd better not. So that's in the Confederation period and beyond. And as president, and I'll end with this, there are a few basic principles in his presidency. He sets the economic policy and the strategy. Lest there be any suggestion that he simply handed everything over to Alexander Hamilton and said, Alex, you figure this out because I can't understand it. Mm-hmm. It didn't work that way. Washington sets the strategy. He sets the policy. What are his primary goals as president? There's a great letter right before he becomes president. He says, as president, to build the national prosperity shall be my first and my only aim as president. that sets the standard right away. His primary goal is to build the foundations for American prosperity. Economic policy is extremely important to him. So what does he focus on? Developing and maintaining the national credit means you show that you pay your debts. Establish a sound and stable currency. Establish the basis for domestic and international commerce. Further as much as possible the infrastructure of communication and trade. And finally, and above all, keep the peace. Domestic and international peace is the basis of commerce, and commerce is the basis of prosperity. He believes that the role of government, now people often ask me, and we can talk about it in Q&A, what would he have thought about the situation today? It's almost impossible to say, although you can infer a lot. His understanding of the role of government, which was shared by many of the others, was that the government must tax. It must have the power to acquire revenue so that it can do these things that I just spoke about, above all keeping the peace. But that government's role was to clear the field, to set a level playing field, to create the conditions where people, by virtue of their own industry, can become prosperous. And finally, there's one element that's extremely important in my book, which is slavery. Slavery is not just a sideshow. It's not just something that's, oh, by the way, he held slaves. It's a very important part of his life. He accepts it as a young man and as an adult for much of his adult life. I think what turned him away from slavery ultimately and convinced him to free the slaves in his will was a simple cost-benefit, labor-benefit calculation, meaning that the motivation to innovate and to achieve is the ability to enjoy the fruits of your own labor and the opportunity to provide prosperity for yourself, your children, your family. When you deny that to enslaved people, you not only corrupt them morally, as he believed, but you corrupt yourself. And he came to believe that slavery would become an economic drag on the country in the long run, as well as on himself. I would like to say that it was a simple moral revulsion that he saw. How can we hold our fellow human beings in slavery? And I think eventually it became that. It took on the tones of that. But the first reaction was one of slavery ultimately will ruin prosperity, hopes of prosperity, and the economy. So that's a brief summary of what goes into my book, and I look forward to discussing it with all of you. Thank you.
Well, thank you both so much. And I'll just say, since Tony Williams and Steve Knott are not here, that they also concur on the relationship between Hamilton and Washington, and that's a strong theme through their book as well, the book about Washington and Hamilton. So I'm going to start with a question, and then as they answer that one, if you want to raise your hand, we have microphones, so please wait for the microphone to get to you before you answer your question. So I'd like to just kind of kick this off. First of all, I think it's interesting to think about how perceptions of Washington and what he's meant to the nation have changed over time. And I was wondering if you could each comment briefly about how U.S. history has affected that, has sort of different places in U.S. history where our views on Washington have either changed or taken on particular relevance for the American people and the country as a whole.
Yeah. Well, Ed opened up the door to Mary, and I'll talk a little about Mary because obviously I've done a lot of work on her and written about her extensively and have a bunch of things to say. And we'll use her to answer your question as sort of a way to open up that issue. So the desire to figure out what this first mother was, how she functioned and what kind of woman she was, is, as we mentioned before, sort of, you know, a longstanding, powerful one with very little to go on. What we do know from the documents is that later in his life and her life, there's a tension. He certainly had concerns about the way she was managing things. It doesn't mean that she's managing them poorly, right? But he does have concerns, and he and his brother-in-law, Fielding Lewis, seem to conspire in some cases. And even earlier on, and maybe Lawrence Washington as part of this, but seem to conspire to sort of reach in and manage. 1750, they redistribute her enslaved property. with she doesn't really have any role in that, but they do it. So she is sort of in an interesting place where whatever she might be doing well, she's also doing it in a society that's sort of not structured to accept her natural authority, and she has sort of powerful men around her sort of working to second-guess her and undermine her. So any success she has in some respects really are a testament to her ability to survive in an environment that really is rather hostile. But the 19th century turned to her and sort of invented her as a weeping, pious, psalm-reading woman who would sort of clutch her son, and the two would weep and read psalms together. And this is a sort of literature and art. We see this over and over again. This sort of saccharine, very 19th century idealization of who this woman was and what that means for the way that Washington was being brought up. So if you cast a mother that way, you create a particular kind of child. And there's any number of lithographs and etchings that show them sort of, you know, reading together and weeping, and this whole sort of invention of her as this pious, doting, weepy mother. And that's all well and good. And something changes in the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And I phrase it this way, that the sociology mathematics of what a person is, what creates character, what creates what we would call personality, changes. So there's sort of a shift that has nothing to do with Washington or that, the discussion of Washington, but floats into how the people who are doing their writing start to discuss him. If you were in 1910 to look at the way that 1850 or 1840 portrayed Mary Washington, you're presented with a problem. And that's that if you do the mathematics, the new social mathematics, the new theoretical sociology, if you take a childless man who does not have a father and has a weeping, doting, pious mother with whom he has a close, affectionate relationship, and you draw a line under that and put an addition sign next to it, the result is a homosexual. They understand that leading to creating a particular personality type. And that obviously becomes a concern for biographers who are looking into this space and trying to create a particular kind of narrative. And you get a sea change. You start to get a whole new discussion of who Mary Washington is. She becomes the harridan. She becomes the, as Samuel Morrison is one of the most vocal of these sort of exponents of this idea, that she's a harridan. You know, she becomes the querulous Mary Washington. Washington's first trial, his first test, was his mother. So she becomes flinty. These are all adjectives that are sort of in the discussion. She becomes this sort of hard figure that he then now needs to test himself against. And all of this serves to sort of expunge this previous problem by suggesting there isn't a weeping pious mother at all. There is this tough, problematic, and you know, he doesn't love her, and she may not love him, but by golly, you know, you get the spark because the metal and the flint hit each other, right? And you got to get the spark somehow. So it might not be happy for either side of the tinder, but there it goes. And the other thing that happens in this that's interested me for a while is the invention of Lawrence Washington as a new father figure. Washington is a little distant on Lawrence. It's not clear exactly what he thinks of their relationship, and I've got some stuff on this and some other stuff I'm working on, but it's a little vague, but certainly he needs to be the replacement father, and you see the invention of him in the literature as a replacement father. So there's a case where, you know, not about politics necessarily, right, but where the flow of the way people are simply thinking over time shifts, and as a consequence, the discussion of Washington changes. It is a commonplace now, to the point of once you're sensitive to it, now everybody is. You'll see in the literature that the more somebody is bashing Mary Washington, the more you have to say to yourself, yeah, no, they're doing that because that's a received thing, right? They've learned to do that. They haven't actually done the work to do that. So that's just one example, I think.
That's interesting. As an aside about Lawrence Washington, it's very clear that George had great affection for Lawrence, but also he was rather disgusted by Lawrence's dismal abilities as a businessman. Mm-hmm. And that's true for other associates he had during his life. Now, the view of George, too, has changed profoundly over the years. I've always been a bit fascinated by this period between World War I and up through the 1960s, really, and that after World War I, there was this kind of questioning period of American traditional values and received wisdom on patriotism, et cetera, et cetera. And Washington went through what I call the debunking period, or what others call the debunking period as well, when attacking him actually became kind of trendy, and viewing him as kind of a lout, even as a young man. So it went through that period in the 20s and 30s where, even despite the the bicentennial of his birth in 1932. He was under quite a bit of attack. And after, I'm especially interested, and I'd like to see some more work done on this, World War II, Washington is essentially invisible in American propaganda. He's just not there. He is in World War I, but in World War II, there are no posters, there are very few references to him, he just disappears. And in the Cold War, even, there are very few references to Washington. He's there in schools, but and his picture is in every school. But he's viewed as being boring, almost, and unapproachable and uninteresting. You really only see this kind of powerful revival of interest in Washington, especially in the Reagan presidency, although there's a bit of it before that. So it's endlessly fascinating. You've done some great work on that, too. I mean, how these views change over time.
You say World War II. A friend of mine works on the Lincoln Brigade. And I was talking to them once. I said, "Well, why is there never a Washington Brigade?" Yeah. And he said, "Actually, they had a discussion about that. There was a discussion, and they decided to go with Lincoln rather than Washington. But they did consider that for the military side. But there are part of the thing that comes to mind in this is that there are sort of strange invocations of Washington, and that happens through the American Nazi Party." Mm-hmm. That rather famous rally in the 1930s in Madison Square Garden, where you've got sort of two swastika banners hanging on either side and that gigantic portrait of Washington in the middle. There's a 1936 Life magazine article. I wish it was an article. It's really just a photograph and a caption, but wow. That just shows American Nazis somewhere in New Jersey, in uniform with this picture of Washington, with the famous half-finished picture of Washington. And the caption just says, "American Nazis hail Washington as first American fascist." So so there is that sort of, when you go through that debunking period, you sort of denude the character of content, and then you can sort of fill with whatever you want. And that's a fascinating little place that I've sort of wanted to play out a little bit, the sort of the development of this sort of, particularly on the far right, this sort of interest in Washington and what sort of emerges from that. So, where there are invocations of him, they're the wrong invocations of him. So, yeah, that's right. It's
great. So if you have a question, if you want to raise your hand, the volunteers with the microphone will come around. Otherwise, I can keep going. But if you please jump in, if you have any questions, we'd love to hear from you. Anything you want to ask these authors about Washington or the Revolution or anything along those lines. Good. Yeah.
Soundtrack. Can you hear? Okay.
Yes.
This is really for Ed. One of the last statements you said about Washington and predicting that slavery would be bad for the economy, do you think that proved true over the next 50 odd years till they get to the Civil War?
Well, yes, in the sense that Washington came to believe that a continued reliance on slavery, and he doesn't go into a great level of detail about this, but it's there in his letters, that continued reliance on slavery will deter innovation, that it will deter the development of manufacturing and deter the development of prosperity. In the South, certainly there was a cotton boom. Later on, there was some basis for the development of wealth, but over the long term, the South became an economic backwater compared to the North. I'm not a historian of slavery, but I think in general terms, some of his predictions were borne out. Yeah.
While we wait for the next question, can you talk a little bit about, in your book, about the Washington, you spent some time on Washington's move away from cotton. Move away from tobacco, which was very interesting in terms of he seemed to be very far ahead of that move away from other farmers in the area. Is that, was he kind of on the forefront of that move away, understanding that one crop was ruining his farmland?
Right. So he wasn't, that's a good question. He certainly wasn't the first planter to move away from tobacco, but he was in the forefront of that move and that of that change. I think it speaks a lot to his courage, given that American, the gentry and the Virginia gentry in particular, had depended for generations, including in his own family, on the cultivation of tobacco, and that Washington saw and made, he studied the problem carefully once he saw himself falling into debt. He studied the problem of why that he was falling into debt, what were the problems with the tobacco economy, what might I move into instead. And then once he made that decision, he did it and he followed and he went with it and made the change to wheat very rapidly. Part of the idea with the change over to wheat was self-sustainability. I like to think of if you rode or walked through Mount Vernon before the changeover to wheat, it would have been a very quiet place. It would have been almost bucolic, just the tilling of tobacco, the cultivation of tobacco, not a whole lot else going on, very, very quiet and very stifling in some ways. After the changeover to wheat, because wheat is much less labor-intensive, the labor on his estate, both the enslaved people and the free labor, could focus not just on cultivating crops, but they could spin and weave and produce their own clothing. They could develop the blacksmith shop, do ironworking. They could cobble and make their own shoes. They could work in the fishery. They could produce their own sustenance, the food that they eat, and they could sell all over the East Coast and into the Caribbean. George Washington brand flour becomes actually a fairly popular brand. So you're not just producing and trading for credit one commodity, but you're diversifying, you're sustaining yourself, and you're earning a profit. It's an amazing transformation.
I can't tell you who the author was or even when it was, but something that seems negative about Washington, and that when he was a young man, I think 21 maybe, and a leader in the militia, that part of the responsibility at the end of the French and Indian War was to compensate volunteers, the foot soldiers, if you will, with lands, what would then be, I guess, considered Western lands. And that Washington, along with, I think, other officers, either didn't do that or they certainly took the best lands for themselves. I guess, first of all, I want to know, is there any truth to that? And if so, you know, how do either one of you interpret that in light of Washington's early desire to make something of himself and his abhorrence of debt and so forth?
Well, there are lawsuits around, right? I mean, those accusations exist at the time. There are veterans who are complaining about this, so it's not a creation after the fact. I think it's important to keep in mind that as soon as Washington bought into the game of surveying, which he does very early, he is self-consciously, quite knowingly, embarking on an endeavor that is about taking land from people, you know, at its very core. One of the things I'm working right now on a book that is sort of what I'm calling an archaeological biography of Washington. What I'm doing is looking at a variety of different Washington sites, every site I can find that has something to say, and sort of seeing what kind of story we get of Washington when we look at the land, when we work from sites upward. And the transition to from tobacco is very important because it has an enormous effect on how Mount Vernon functions as a place. You're absolutely right. It's a completely, completely different environment and different in most respects from other local neighboring plantations. But that's a self-conscious thing. There's an awareness of that, that this sort of entering into that game. So one of the things I point out is that we mentioned John Washington earlier. I have a sort of different take on John Washington in some ways. I tie him very closely with Nathaniel Pope, who is his father-in-law, and sort of root him in Maryland and changes that are happening in Maryland. But John Washington and Nathaniel Pope both knew indigenous people. They dealt with indigenous people on a practically daily basis. They were around where they live. Nathaniel Pope is a fur trader. He's involved in the fur trade that goes all the way up the Chesapeake Bay, up to it extends all the way up to the Great Lakes, actually, because the Susquehannock Indians are sort of middlemen partners. So they're bringing furs down from upstate New York into Kent Island in the Chesapeake. And John Washington's involved in this trade. When John Washington came to Virginia, he came from Copenhagen and Danzig. So, you know, we kind of lose sight of that sort of weird internationalism, but that's where he arrived from. So he's involved in a very complicated international trade. They knew indigenous people. John Washington killed indigenous people. They were afraid of him. He had a relationship with them. I don't think there's any reason whatsoever to think that Augustine Washington ever saw an indigenous person in his local environment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The world has changed so much by that point through a process of clearing. When George Washington first sees an indigenous person, he's a little bit of Twitter. It's an interesting thing. It's an uncommon occurrence. Now, ultimately, as he heads westward, he's going to have much more of an encounter with them and come to know them fairly well. Colin Calloway has a book coming out soon on exactly this question of Washington and the Indians. But the act of surveying involves, as he would know, consciously displacing people and taking land. So I don't think you phrased it as bad. I'm not sure where we fit that. Do you know what I mean? It's certainly, these are the nature, when it comes to the sort of the issue with the veterans, this is sort of the nature of this kind of land dealing. And there's, when you read Washington's papers closely, which people don't often do, I'll let Ed comment on this more because it speaks to this issue of entrepreneurialism, business practices. He is extremely hard driving. I mean, he will get what he wants. He is a very uncompromising guy in many respects. You know, when he wants something, he pursues it aggressively, and he's very dismissive of opponents, and he's very politic. He knows how to sort of do one thing in one place and talk in another, talk differently in another. But he is a very driven man. I think there is, some people have argued, sort of a softening over time. Whether that's natural or circumstantial, it's hard to tell. But I think we remove an 18th century context if we sort of want him to not be, you know, an aggressive Virginia landowner of the 18th century. I think that's who he is and that's how he acts.
There are a couple of quick comments I'd make on that. First of all, yes, Washington was very hard driving. He was not ruthless. He had a strong system of personal ethics, which was very important to him, which is not to say that he never did wrong, but is to say that he tried very strictly, and self-discipline was extremely important to him. He tried very strictly to keep his endeavors within the realm of his own personal system of ethics. And he could not have personally reconciled himself, I believe, with deliberately cheating or deliberately trying to ruin somebody or trying to impoverish them. What he did with land certainly was that in that period, acquiring land was very important to him. He took advantage of the circumstances in that period to acquire more land, and in many cases it was veterans trading in and selling their land certificates, whatever they were called, for money because they needed money right then. So somebody came to him and said, I have this western land, I need money right now, I'm willing to, trade it into you for some cash, ready cash. You said, okay, I'll do that, but not cheating. The other thing I'd say with indigenous people, because it's a very important topic and a very complex topic, Washington was astonishingly naive, but he did not consciously in his mind think, we're going to take this land from native people, we're going to dispossess them because we want it and they don't matter. His belief was, and you look at his presidential policy, his belief was if you trade and you develop commerce with Native Americans, ultimately they will develop a shared sense of interest, again that phrase coming up, with the United States, and they will become integrated into our system. That's how he thought about it. And he did not see, even though the evidence was before him, that continual Western expansion inevitably involved conflict. He didn't see it that way as conflict. He viewed it as kind of an expansion and integration. That was how he reconciled it in his own mind. So I think it's important not to think of him, and I know you didn't use this word, although some people do, of Washington as some kind of pseudo-imperialist. he's thinking in terms of conquest and destruction and just taking what I want. He just didn't think that way.
You know, Jefferson talks about, or muses about the possibility of intermarriage as a way to sort of bring people together. So he imagines a world in which indigenous people and European descendants will intermarry and eventually become sort of one thing. And you're sort of suggesting, I think it's right, that that Washington's vision of this is an economic one, that we'll, our affairs, so to speak, will become so intertangled and intertwined that we will become sort of one interest. It's absolutely true. I didn't use the word imperialist for a reason. I don't think he's driving that horse. But we do see, you know, he's very rough on squatters when squatters are on his land. He's very eager to kind of move them along. And we do see a couple instances. There's one very clear one where there's a neighbor who has property that he wants, just a little piece he wants to fill in. And he writes back and forth with, I think it's John Augustine he's writing to. I'm not sure. It's probably not Lund. But he says, well, you know, he's not in hard straits yet. We'll just wait. So, you know, the letter I mean, he just says, you know, he will want a more advantageous deal for us in time. So we'll just wait it out. We've got time. He doesn't have time. It'll fall to us eventually. You know, is that bad? I mean, that's the nature of the practice, right? I mean, that's trying to get the best possible deal one can get. And in our economic conception, we don't consider that wrong, and he did not consider that wrong. So I think we agree about that. It's that you know, he's trying to get an advantageous deal, but. I agree that I don't think he's consciously at any point, it would be very difficult for him to reconcile his own understanding of himself to sort of consciously cheat, right?
I have two quick questions. I read a book that said Martha Washington was never called Martha. It was always Patsy. And what do you think of the popularity of the Washington spy series on television called Turn?
I've never seen it, so I haven't had a television since 1988. So I'm, you know,
you can take the Martha question.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that I've put the time into figuring that out. I see Patsy used in secondary literature. I don't know. See Mrs. Washington a lot in documents. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I think he did at least often call her Patsy. It's interesting. There's a little bit of correspondence left between them, even though she burned almost everything. There were a few things left over, and you see the way they address each other. There's a wonderful little letter from 1777 where Martha is writing to George from Mount Vernon. And it's just a little note on the back of another letter where she talks to him about a silver cup she just bought. And in this little casual note, she calls him my love. After they've been married almost 20 years, they're in their 40s. And, you know, it's like if you give your spouse a grocery shopping list, you write at the top, my love, please pick these things up at the grocery. And that's expressive there, I think. And on the... on the TV series Turn, I've heard a lot about it. I haven't watched it either, believe it or not. Although one of my colleagues here, who I will not call out, knows much more about it than I do. But my sense is that the producers and especially the actors very much want to get it right. They very much want to be accurate. From what I've heard, the gentleman who portrays George Washington is very particular about this, but that in producing a show of this nature, the directors, the producers feel that they have to have some degree of dramatic license, so they carry things further than I would be comfortable with as a historian, such as Washington practically having a nervous breakdown, as I understand, at Valley Forge. And as I hear, I don't know if it's come out yet, breaking down and sobbing when he hears about Benedict Arnold's treason. You know, yeah, there were times when we have documentary evidence of Washington having tears dripping down his cheeks over something he felt very emotional about, but actually sobbing in public, probably not.
There's sort of an inadvertent answer to your question, of course, is two people who, you know, are in academe and are writing and thinking about Washington, and neither of us have seen the series. So maybe it, you know, tells you something about how people like us prioritize our time, I guess. You
know? We're going to try to get a few more questions. I know there are two or three more that we have here, and then we'll give some time for the books.
Y'all talked about strong women marrying into the Washington family. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about how Martha may have impacted George's lifestyle and choices he made?
Sure, I can say some about that. You may want to get in there too, Phil. There have been a couple of books, one by Pat Brady, Martha Washington, An American Life, and Flora Fraser has just come out with a book on them as a couple. To me, it's clear that Martha was not what we'd think of as a modern 21st century woman. She was still a product of her times, but she shared with George a sense of common purpose, which was, you know, she just didn't think, okay, I'm handing over my property to George and he'll manage it and whatever he thinks is right. They both shared the same concept that we need to not only maintain but develop and pursue prosperity for our heirs, for our family. So they had a shared sense in that. I also think she helped impose discipline on him. I love in the financial papers, if you look at the money he spends on gambling, cards and billiards. He likes to gamble, and he loses money on it. Right up to 1759, you can see the expenses kind of going up here. Then he marries Martha, and that's it. You know. Or is that, well, no, I think he was, because in 1762... suddenly the cards go up a little bit again, and I can just see him whining to Martha. I said, come on, I want to go out with the guys and play some cards. But I think she did have kind of a restraining impact on him in some ways.
There are a few things that come to mind. One of them, obviously, is the impact that bringing her into the family sort of had on his fortunes, right? The amount of land he held, property that he owned. And one of the things I'm looking at right now as I'm playing out this archaeology is a question that is treated oftentimes as just a received thing, but never doesn't get treated as an actual question, which is why he chose to live at Mount Vernon, to treat Mount Vernon as an active choice rather than just sort of a thing that falls in his lap, recognizing that he owns a number of properties. And after 1759, he has access to her properties also, which some of which he sells off. But you know, he could move to Williamsburg, and you would think one iteration of him would want to move to Williamsburg, and he doesn't. So a door is open that he doesn't go through, and she's part of that. One thing to tie up the thing about Mount Vernon that sort of is an important piece of this, in the way she sort of is there in a shadow form. When he started his lease with Mount Vernon in 55, I think 56 is the first year he paid, he had to pay for a series of, he rented it till 61, till Anne Fairfax's eventual death. And he pays, it's supposed to pay about £98 a year, but he pays, I think, 86 in practice, in tobacco. But slavery is sort of tied into that lease, because the lease is a certain number of pounds of tobacco minus a certain amount for every enslaved person. And the men are valued one way, women are valued another, and a guy named Caesar is valued less than all of them. And something happens, and he's gone. And I think his loss seems to account for the difference between the actual debt and what he pays. But slavery is sort of, at the very beginning of his ownership, very beginning of his tenancy at Mount Vernon, slavery is fundamentally tied into the nature of his ownership. Rather famously, at the end of his residency at Mount Vernon, he frees his enslaved people, but he only frees those that he owns. He doesn't own all of them. Martha owns a number of them. And what he does is he writes it out so that they will attain their freedom on her passing, so that he doesn't have to break up families. But I find it interesting that slavery, this relationship with slavery, it sort of sits on both ends of his relationship with Mount Vernon, first built into the lease, but then in the end, but it's marriage and family that's at the end. That's what he's privileging. And the relationship that he has with Martha is sort of mirrored in these relationships with his enslaved people and her enslaved people, who now are sort of tied to this place as well. So it's sort of brackets, but she's sort of a factor in that as well. So.
I speak from a position of great ignorance, but...
We all do.
you spoke, he changed from tobacco to wheat. And obviously this was a business choice, and I don't know. I know he had a personal distillery in which he used some of the wheat, but that could not have been all of it. I don't know if he had any flour mills he sold to them, or he had personal ones.
He had a mill. Yes. The mill, actually, there's a mill on the Mount Vernon land. Before he's even there, Lawrence Washington, his brother, refers to a mill, and, okay. and there's some investment of a mill before. Washington may have rebuilt the mill, and you can actually see it. It's been reconstructed. It was reconstructed in the 1930s, and in a wonderful little sort of history having an effect on how we talk about Washington, the excavations in the 1920s that located the footprint for both the grist mill and for the distillery, which, of course, right next to each other because it works sympathetically, they reconstructed the grist mill in the 20s, but buried the distillery and just didn't want to talk about it because in the middle of Prohibition, they didn't want to rebuild Washington's whiskey distillery. So.
Yeah, he invested money twice, quite a lot of money, in renovating his grist mill. He also had another mill on some of his land in western Pennsylvania, and so he, at those mills, he ground flour and sold that flour.
Did the colonists import flour from England at one point? Did I hear that somewhere?
They may have early on, but by the time Washington invested in it, and certainly by the time we became independent, we became one of the most important producers of flour in the world. In the early 19th century, flour production just explodes, partly from investing in new technology.
I think very early, the earliest colonies have importations, but very quickly, corn replaces that, and then they start growing wheat.
Yeah,
putting barrels of flour in a transatlantic vessel is not the best use of space.
Let's try to get this one last question in before we...
Thank you for sharing your expertise with us. I think it was Ed that said that one characteristic of Washington was to try to gather information, data about different things, and it made me think of his collection of maps. Was that because of that characteristic, or because as a surveyor and a military man that might have been something that he found very helpful and interesting to him?
It was that's a good question, and it's a combination of both, really, as I'm sure you've seen too, looking at Washington as a young man and as a teenager. Through the process of being a surveyor, he acquires an almost instinctive passion for land, and it's not just mapping out and surveying land, but the land itself he comes to see as a source of wealth, growth, and prosperity. And I think it's partly, and he's fascinated with geography generally. I think it's one of his favorite subjects. He's fascinated not just with land, but with waterways and how waterways connect different areas and different parts of land globally as well as domestically. So, yeah, that collection of maps was both a reflection of his military experience, but also his passion for land and geography.
A map also, I mean, the gentry in general put a huge priority on this. So the Jefferson Fry map is a very important project. Augustin Herman's map, there's a book coming out soon on Augustin Herman's map. It's hard for us in our sort of information-rich age to be able to step back and understand just how little information is available in the middle of the 18th century. And to have a map is just a phenomenally important piece of data. So, you know, the more you have of them, the more you understand it. Henry the Navigator in Portugal has his map, you know, at Point Sagres, you know, Cape Sagres, you know, locked away. You can't see that map. And every mariner is required to go to see him when they return to port to go secretly add their information to it. Maps are powerful, powerful tools in this, as well as sort of symbols of knowledge and ownership. So I think it's to want to be the producer of those sorts of things as well, it places him very much, I think, you know, in the forefront of wanting to produce and acquire knowledge. So they're very resonant symbols.
Well, with that, we're going to wrap this up. Thank you all so much for coming for this session, and thank you to Ed and Phil.